Hello, everybody. My name is Leo. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Could somebody tell everybody to come inside because they're going to miss a tremendous speaker? Would you please come inside? My name is Leo. As I said, I'm an alcoholic, and I am very honored to introduce the speaker tonight. I come from Poland. That's why I speak perfect English. And my first meeting was in November the 3rd, 1970. That's my sobriety date. I went to a church in the Bronx, and then I came to Florida with 2 years sobriety, and I immediately went to see a meeting in Pine Hills, and I met this outstanding gentleman by the name of Paul B. that I am about to introduce. We became very good friends. As a matter of fact, he opened up the door to his beautiful home. I was using his boat, I was using his swimming pool. I got friendly with his friends. I had access to all his food in the refrigerator, and I almost like lived with him for a while. And it happened to be a very, very good friendship in the AA, and I got to know more and more about this wonderful gentleman. I needed him badly because I didn't speak too good English, and being a teacher, I could use his education. And now, therefore, I would like to introduce to you the most outstanding educator that educated me in my English speaking. I would like you to know that if there was any job to be done in service, I know that Paul B. did. As a matter of fact, he also was the chairman of Intergroup at one time. He has never stopped going to meetings, has been always active, and I have heard him several times speaking, and every time I hear that he's going to speak someplace, I come and I'm anxiously to hear him speak. So without any further ado, let me join you all, giving him an extreme warm welcome, the one and only educator of my English, Paul B.
I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Paul. If everybody I taught English in all those years in the classroom sound like Leo, the state might want their money back they paid me. But anyway, it's great to be here. I just said to Curious a few minutes ago, isn't it neat to stand here and see all these people and just feel the love that's around us? There's no negativism, no negative vibes in this air at all. It's an atmosphere of love. Even if we don't know each other, we know that we are concerned about each other, and that's love in action. And that's what the foundation of the program is. I want to tell you a couple little stories, and one involves a rabbi named Leo. And the other involves a real neat, congenial, intelligent, well-educated, Catholic priest, Father Paul. Now, Father Paul is driving down the street in his automobile. Of course, he's in the right lane. He's not exceeding the speed limit. He has everything in control. But coming at him about 300 yards away is an automobile that's swerving all over the place, one lane to the other, and finally it settles down in the wrong lane and it's headed right at Father Paul's automobile and is being driven by Rabbi Leo. Now, the two cars collide. Father Paul, in his sincere compassion, gets out, and he says, Rabbi Leo, are you all right? Rabbi Leo says, I'm very nervous. So, Father Paul takes out a fifth of liquor, and he says, here, take two or three good swigs of this. Slush it around in your mouth real good before you swallow it. So Leo does that, three big swigs. Then Father Paul says, while you were doing that, I had a revelation from our God. And our God said that you need to take some of this liquor and put it on your fingers and rub your forehead with it real good. Put some more on your fingers and rub your cheeks and your neck with it real good. And take three more slugs and swash it around in your mouth real good before you swallow it. So Rabbi Leo did all of that. And when he was finished, he handed the bottle to Father Paul, and he says, "Now, Father Paul, you have some." And Father Paul said, "No, thank you. I'm going to wait until after the police get here." There's a friend of mine down at Alcoland named George Smith. I don't see him here, but usually he's at all these functions. We've been good friends for many years. We're about the same age. And George has been... his memory is not what it used to be. And for years he has volunteered me to speak at places. In the last two or three years he volunteers me but does not call up and tell me when I'm supposed to speak. So one way or the other I find out about it. But tonight I want to get even with George Smith. And I'm going to tell you a very, very personal story about him. I know many of you know him. A very intimate story. And the reason I'm taking this liberty is because I know you practice the principle of what you hear here, leave here. And so nobody's going to reveal this story outside of this room. George is, as I said, up in years, and he has decided he wanted to leave the best part of him behind. So he made an appointment at a sperm bank. And when he arrived there, the nurse handed him a jar. And she said, "Now go down to the end of the hall, last room on the right, and when you're finished, push that button on the wall, and a buzzer will ring in the office, and I'll come down to the room." So 30 minutes passed, and no buzzer. The nurse says, "Well, George is an old man, I'll give him some more time." Another 30 minutes passes, and she gets busy and forgets about him. Another 30 minutes passes, and she went down and knocked on a door, and George opened the door. And the nurse says, "Are you all right, George?" And George says, "Well, for the first 30 minutes, I tried with my right hand, and I didn't do any good. The second 30 minutes, I tried with my left hand, and it didn't do any good. In the third 30 minutes, I tried with both hands, and I still cannot get the top off of that jar." old people jokes. I heard a lot of them in the last few years. My favorite, though, is the one about the old man who goes to the doctor, and he says, "Doctor, I can't hear." The doctor looks at him and says, "No wonder you can't hear, you got a suppository in your ear." And the old man says, "Oh, thank you, doctor, now I know where I put my hearing aid." All right, now that's all. I'm not going to tell anything worse than that. I don't, that's as bad as I get. But anyway, I was born in a little town up in Kentucky. My father had six children, five girls and me. I have six children. I was number four in the sequence of kids. I'm not from an alcoholic family. I heard a man say one time, "If you're not from a dysfunctional or alcoholic family, I'm not going to believe anything you say." Well, he would not believe me because I'm honestly not from an alcoholic family. My mother and father, my father supported 10 people. And we never saw anything. We were brought up during the Depression years and all that, and we never wanted for anything. My sisters and I still say that. My oldest sister became a nun. The next two sisters, number two and number three, got degrees in business and married businessmen and stayed married all their life. I was number four. I had this disease called alcoholism, and it showed up early. I believe I was born with it. I don't believe I developed into it, across the line, or any of these expressions. I believe because of the personality problems I had, some people think I still have, that I had this disease for a long time. The next sister under me was a nurse, worked for many years for a doctor, died when she was 53 years old from alcoholism because her liver stopped functioning. At 53, she died in January 1980. I stood in front of her casket that Saturday morning, and the doctor put his arm around my shoulder, and her name was Ann. He said, "Ann never in her life ever accepted any kind of rehabilitation. And we're blessed, those of us who are using this program and are not drinking, we have accepted the rehabilitation that God has given us in His graces. And for that, you can't help but be grateful. My youngest sister was born in 1930. Her husband died in May of 1977, and she hasn't been sober since. She's just barely alive, but she lives to drink. 3 times I sent AA people to her house, she would not let them in. I go up to, once or twice a year now. I used to go about 4 times a year. But I really feel sorry for her because she's an active alcoholic who is probably closer to death because of drinking alcohol than anybody you could possibly imagine. But she won't quit. She won't make any effort to quit. So of the 3 of us, number 4, number 5, and number 6 children, 3 of us have alcoholism. And 1, through the grace of God, has gained help. And boy, I tell you, I can't hardly say that without stopping and saying a prayer of gratitude. Because God has been so good to me. But anyway, there were 3 churches in this little town. One was a very large Catholic church. One was a smaller Lutheran church and a small Baptist church. We lived in the shadows of the Catholic church. Behind this big Catholic church was a big building that housed 12 nuns. And to the right of the church was another big building that housed 3 priests. To the left of that building was a watch case factory owned by Elgin Watch Company, and my dad worked there 49 and a half years. And that was our life. We lived on 5th Street. The grocery stores were on 6th Street. We never really needed transportation. Until I went to high school, I never left that neighborhood for hardly anything. So anyway, I went to high school in Kentucky. You can skip the 7th and 8th grade. You can take a test in 3 different places in Kentucky, and I did that. I skipped the 7th and 8th grade. Back to college early. By the time I was 17, just before that, I finished a year of college. And this was during the war. They were going to drop the draft age to 18. I went ahead and enlisted in the Navy. I wanted to be a hospital corpsman on a destroyer, because I knew that during the war, those destroyers had about 125 men on them and one hospital corpsman on duty, and that was good duty. But what happened was, after I was at Great Lakes and finished hospital corps school, the beginning of 1943, they transferred me to the Marine Corps. The Navy supplies the Marine Corps their medical department, and I served the next 38 months then with the Marine Corps in the Pacific, and I spent 5 months in China. But that was a big transition for me, because this home I was from was an ideal, loving home. Everybody was lovable. And then I went into the service. But, you know, when I found out that the International Convention was at San Diego, I didn't get there. But I remember I only had 1 liberty in San Diego, and I'm going to share this with you, because I was 18 years old. The last liberty I had before you were going overseas, and I was downtown like where Lake Eola would be in Orlando, but right downtown San Diego, went into a restaurant, they had a soda bar, and I met a cute girl there. She was from Cincinnati, where I had been in college, and she was Catholic, and we kind of clicked it off. So she said she got off at 11 o'clock. Now, you got to realize that in a couple of days from now, I knew that I was going overseas. So she and I went to a late movie, and she said, "Would you like to take me home?" And I said, "Oh, yeah." You know, I was all fluttered. And we got on the bus, and we went to the park, and a lot of her motel. It was an apartment complex that she lived in. Oh, my. Anyway, this... a Freudian slip or something, but... We walked through this parking lot of automobiles, and she says, "This car here belongs to my brother. We can sit in there." Now, what it was a 1940 Ford, the kind that had a bench-type seat going across it and a little shelf in the back of the seat, and that was it. So we got in there, and, of course, we started, you know, smooching and making love and this kind of thing. And eventually, I was on the seat. My back was on the seat. The back of my head was on the door, on the driver's side of the door. My arm was up in the air like this, by my head. You've got to picture this now, folks. Don't leave me for a minute. I'm on this seat with my head up here on the door. She's on top of me, and my right hand is on her buttocks, you see, and the windows are frosting up. Now, God in his divine providence did not want me to go overseas with mortal sin on my soul. So what happened was the door that my head was resting on opened, and my head went back like that. Now, right above my head was Thelma's head looking at this guy. I'm looking at this guy that looked like that big guy in the Munsters, you know, 7 feet tall. My head's down here looking up at him, and he puts his down. Now, we got three heads here in this position. He says, "What in the hell are you doing in my car?" And I says, "Well, your sister's down." Meantime, Thelma's scooting off of me, and she's going out the other door, see. She leaves, and this guy says, "I don't have any sister named Thelma, so I hurry up and get out of the car." And now I'm standing out here in this green Marine Corps uniform looking at this guy. But you know what? The guy could have killed me. But there was a light in back of me, a street light, and the light kind of shined on his face. And there was just a glimpse of humor in those eyes when he looked down at me. He looked down at me and didn't say anything, and he says, "Get the hell out of here." So I left. That was my experience with San Diego. Boy, that's a dumb story to tell, I know. I never told that before, but it's been on my mind since the International Convention was in San Diego. But anyway, back to the family. My oldest sister was a nun. She became a nun in 1933, and she was valedictorian of her class, beautiful young lady. She had a boyfriend named Sammy Hoffman, good German boy, big blonde, blue-eyed German boy. And he would come to the convent and try to talk her into leaving all the time. Of course, she never did. She was a nun until 1994. Last year, she died after 61 years. Well, I came home in 1943 one time. I went to the convent to visit her, and I said to her, "What was the toughest thing that you've had to do as a nun during your first 10 years? And she waited for a minute, and she said, "The heaviest cross I've had to bear as a nun is the fact that you and I look alike." That was her answer. And she had that type of humor all of her life. And she died after many years in the infirmary of the convent up there. And I always brought home jokes about nuns. Three nuns walking across the bridge in Cincinnati, the Ohio River Bridge. And the one nun said, "Did you know that several days ago I found some condoms in the convent?" And the second nun said, "Did you know that several days ago I put holes in each one of them?" And the third nun jumped off the bridge. my favorite nun joke is about the Mother Superior, who had a lot of young nuns, and she thought they needed some entertainment. So she brought them a parakeet. And she said, "Now, I want you young nuns to teach this parakeet how to sing religious songs." But all the parakeet would do is swing very seductively in the top of the cage and say, "Root toot toot, I'm a prostitute. Root toot toot, I'm a prostitute." So this, of course, embarrassed Mother Superior, and she called Father Timothy Donovan, who could solve all the world's problems as long as you were in a state of grace. And he said, "Sister, you have no problem. I have two nuns, Peter and Paul. And all I do is sit in the... I have two nuns, no, I have two parakeets." Oh, my head's ahead of my brain's ahead of my mouth. I have two parakeets, Peter and Paul, and all I do is sit in the bottom of the cage all day long, and Peter reads from the Bible, and Paul prays his beads, his rosary. "We will take your female parakeet, put her in the top of the cage with Peter and Paul, and they will teach her how to sing religious songs." So they took this female parakeet, put it in the top of the cage, and the female parakeet swung very seductively and said, "Root toot toot, I'm a prostitute." Peter and Paul looked up. Peter said, "Paul, put away the book and the beads. Our prayers have been answered." Oh. That's cute, isn't it? I was talking last week. I was in a convention in West Palm Beach. I met a psychiatrist there, fascinating guy. He's in the program, 52 years old. And he has specialized in psychiatric treatment of young people. He said most of his patients are under 25. And he spent 3 years in residency up north somewhere to gain all the knowledge that he has about this. And we had a great conversation. We left the place where the convention was Saturday, and he went out and had dinner. We were talking about ego, and I told him that I felt that when we all come into this program, a mutual characteristic, I believe, and I'm generalizing now, I'm not taking your inventory, I'm just generalizing. I believe that when we come into this program, we have ego problems. In fact, there's a guy down there who I was talking about this to him, and he says someday he's going to write a national anthem of AA, and he's going to call it "All I Got Is Me on My Mind," because the national anthem of AA. But I was this way in the beginning. Well, probably still am. I don't think we ever get over these things. Sometimes I think we camouflage them enough so that people can't see them, but they're always there. All the defects of character that I had on June 4, 1973, when I called AA, I still have. In fact, I think I have some I did not have then. I went to my first meeting on June 5, 1973, and it wasn't long after that I was solving all of your problems. Whatever category your problem was in, I was an expert on that category. I had women down at Alcoan, the old Jackson Street clubhouse, take me outside in the darkness of the light and say, "Paul, it's about time you shut the hell up and listen." And it was, but I didn't listen. At any rate, by the time 1976 came, I was so much an expert on AA that I took a drink. In the next 2.5 years, I'd go to meetings all the time. I never really stopped going to meetings. But working what you learn in a meeting is one thing. You just can't go to meetings. I could not just keep the plug in a jug and go to meetings. That did not work for me. So the next 2.5 years, I'd go 6-7 weeks without a drink, meet somebody, take a drink. Finally, in December the 25th, 1978, I took my last drink, and I am so, so grateful. But this is a program of growth, we know that. You can't stand still. You're either improving yourself along spiritual lines, I personally believe that, or you're going backwards. My five most popular words for me in that whole big book are on the bottom of page 100. It begins a series of paragraphs on living in a world where there's alcoholism. You can't do anything about that. But you can do something about your attitudes and your mind related to alcoholism, to the alcohol around you. And the five words are, assuming you are spiritually fit. Assuming you are spiritually fit. That category of paragraphs begins with that. And I try to live that. I try to diminish my ego as much as I possibly can, because I remember what I was, and I remember what led to that drink in 1976. There was no great disaster at that time. We were over in Clearwater on a vacation. The six kids were great. My wife was in good health. No financial problems or anything. And I said to my wife, "I'm going to go over to that place and get a few beers." She never did try to talk me out of drinking. She never called me an alcoholic. She just handled it in some unbelievably gracious way, and I love her for that. But anyway, that was my last drink in 78. In 1979, we had lived through a lot of years of raising these kids on a school teacher's pay, and that is one heck of a thing to do if you're the only income for 8 people. We would sit at the table that's now in my dining room, some of you kids, I'm thinking your students, some of you folks have been out my house in Claremont, and the dining room table is a table that we sat at, and there would be 8 people there, and I was, you know, I worked more than one job in 19 years, you see. But anyway, in 1979, we started receiving an inheritance, which was great. Everything was paid. The inheritance developed more and more into bigger checks every month. But in 1979, my wife began to lose the ability to speak. In September of 79, about 3 months after these checks started coming in. But we nevertheless planned trips together at that time. The kids were getting grown up enough we could leave them. and we wanted to take some trips, but she got sicker and sicker. She was hospitalized locally here 4 or 5 times, and they could not diagnose her. They told me to take her to Gainesville. I took her to Gainesville, Chan's Hospital. And on April the 15th, 1981, I will always remember that date because of what happened, and also because that was the last time I was tempted to take a drink of alcohol. April 15, 1981. In this neurologist's office, it's a Friday, at 4:30 in the afternoon, he had examined all the records on her and everything. He said to us, looking at her, he says, "You have amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, which is Lou Gehrig's disease. You've had it for a year and a half. You've never gone into remission. At the rate it's progressing, you will live about a year, and here's what's going to happen." And I thought the man was the cruelest creature that God ever made. But I see now that there wasn't much choice on his part. And so I went crazy. My wife didn't bat an eye. We were taking out the automobile. She was put in the car, and I drove home in a rainstorm. And every exit from Gainesville to Orlando, I wanted to get off and take a drink. And that was a powerful temptation. But I didn't do anything except say, "I'm going to go to the next exit." And I did that, whatever number of exits there are. And when I got home, I had 6 telephone numbers, 5 men and a woman. I called them and spent the evening talking on the telephone and did not take a drink. She lived 11 months and 4 days. And on March 19, 1982, she died. Now, the only reason I'm going into detail about that is no matter what crisis you have in your life, whether it's real or whether you have dreamed it up or whether you have caused it or whether it was caused by some force outside of yourself having nothing to do with you, you're going to have a decision to make. The decision is going to be either go drink or strengthen your program. As an alcoholic, I saw that, and I saw that that was the only 2 decisions I had: strengthen the program or drink. And I sure as heck did not want to drink, because I had already had a slip that took me 2.5 years to get out of it. I didn't want that kind of feeling anymore. I didn't want all those emotions that are not in your presence when you have serenity. I did not want any of that. One guy said one time, "Serenity is the absence of bullshit." And I really believe that that's true. There is none of this in your life if you are truly serene. And I wanted to be that way, and if I went and drank, so what I did, I really start working the spiritual part of the program. And in 1981, some woman put on my desk a card, and it said, "Nothing is going to happen that my God and I cannot handle." Now listen to this. I never knew who gave that to me. I had Xerox copies made up, the original I lost. But last 2 weeks ago, I was cleaning out that roll-top desk in my living room that many of you have seen. First time I cleaned it out in about 10 years or more. And there was this card with the lady's name on the back. She was the mother of twin girls that I was teaching in high school, and I remember her vividly. But the card was lost all those years. And that was the inspiration I had in addition to the Serenity Prayer. I was always saying, "Nothing's going to happen today that my God and I can't handle." And I was allowed to visit my wife at 8 o'clock in the morning till 8:20, and I would drop into the Alcoan. I was allowed to visit her at 6 o'clock to 8 till 20 after 6, and I would go to Alcoan. Nobody bothered me at school if I was late or anything, because they knew what was going on. But I did not have a temptation to drink. Now, this isn't any exaltation of me in any way, because it's totally the help of spiritual of God in my life. And I pray that you and your program are growing spiritually. The foundation of our program is that. But ego was a big, big thing with me. And there's a passage in the... I know we're not supposed to talk about the Bible and all that, but I want to talk a little bit, because I use it in my daily readings, and I use it in my life. One time the 12 apostles were walking down this road on the way to Capernaum, and they must have had alcoholic tendencies, because if you listen to their personalities sometimes, these things come out. So the 12 apostles were walking down this road on the way to the city they were going to, and they were arguing amongst themselves who was the greatest. Didn't that sound typically like a group of alcoholics together? very little growth in the program. Of course, they hadn't known Christ very long, or the teachings of Christ very long, so they probably only had, you know, 2 or 3 weeks at meetings, or whatever. Whatever they had then. In back of them was walking Christ far enough away that they didn't think he could hear them, but he did. So now they got to the room at the Holiday Inn in Capernaum, wherever it was they stayed, and they went all in there, and Christ made them sit down, and he said to them, now picture the alcoholic personalities here. He said to them, what were you arguing about on the way? They were all silent. They refused to answer him, of course. And so he said to them, and this is what I like, this has helped my ego a lot, if you want to be the greatest, you got to be the least of all and the servant of all. If you want to be the greatest, you have to be the least of all and the servant of all. And it reminds us of a prayer. It's from the book of the wisdom of Sirach in the Old Testament. This prayer comes from. And it says, exalt not yourself, lest the world finds out about you and really reveals what you are. Exalt not yourself. So right after that, I always say a prayer, a Catholic prayer. And in it I say, today it is important for me not to be important. Because I had fantasized through all the years of my young life about being something great. I was not. When I went into the Marine Corps as a hospital corpsman, they had 2 names for me. I hope this doesn't shock anybody. But this is what the Marines used to call me. They either called me, there were 150 men in the company, 75 of them would call me Paul the Pecker Checker, and the other 75 would call me Paul the Penis Machinist. Now those were the most complimentary names that I had. And yet from that low-level type of arrogant, insulting talk, my ego would get greater and greater. I was somebody great. And when I came in, you could not have a program without me, folks. But we passed through that. I never understood this humility thing because I always thought of it as part of monks and nuns and a convent. But one night, I taught at Seminole Junior College 11 years, and Valencia 3 years. But one of those nights, I came home from Seminole about 10:45, and the finals of the Miss America contest were on. And Bert Parks, or whatever his name is, who was the master of ceremonies, was standing there with 5 beautiful women, the finalists. And he says, I'm going to ask each one of you a question. You're not going to hear what the other's questions are. You'll be in the other room. So the first beautiful young lady standing on the stage all by herself, and the camera zoomed in on her face, and he asked this question, what is humility? And her eyes immediately were searching for an answer. You could tell that because all you had on that TV was her face. And she waited a minute and she said, humility is a virtue which if you have it, you don't know it. And once you begin to think you have it, you're losing it. Therefore, I think humility is an offshoot of all the other virtues that we develop in this program. I don't believe, no, this is personal, don't believe me if you don't want to, I don't believe we can leave the house at 2:00 in the afternoon and say, from now till 6:15, I am going to practice humility. I don't think it works that way. I think it's an offshoot of becoming honest, of becoming tolerant, of becoming patient, of becoming a listener, of becoming a learner, you see. And from these things, we develop humility. We're not the most important person in the world anymore. Last week at Alta Vista, I was in a new meeting. Man was in there for the first meeting. He was right alongside of me. And of course, he said his name. He said his first meeting. And I said to him, you are the most important person in this room. But you won't be tomorrow's meeting. Because if you are growing in the program, you are becoming less and less. Not as a person, you're becoming greater as a person. You're becoming a person that sees yourself as insignificant, not the important egotistical maniac, at least that I was. I remember one time, I hate to tell this story because it makes me feel like such a donkey, but there was a guy that I was sponsoring one time in this stage I was at, of recovery, if you want to call that recovery, and he said to me, why don't you ever let us, the ones I sponsor, why don't you ever let us take other people's inventory? My answer was, because you would not do it as accurately as I do. Yeah, isn't that sad? That's sick. That's sick. I used to stand in front of these classes in Maynard Evans High School, particularly. I taught 12th grade English, honors English. It'd be the honors program today. It was called advanced then. And these kids really needed to get good grades before they applied for these Ivy League schools they wanted to get into. And they were great, great kids. But I thought, you know, I stood before these groups there in a Seminole Junior College, and I must certainly have presented the image of at least someone like Tom Selleck to all these people, standing in front of them, looking at me. However, the nickname the kids had for me was Mr. Magoo. And that name stayed with me for a number of years. I made the mistake one Friday, about 3:10, the school ended at 3 o'clock, of asking this one class, honors class, why they call me Mr. Magoo? A girl named Susan, I will never forget that girl, I won't say her last name, but Susan was her first name, stood up in the middle of the class to answer, which they never did, they always sat down and answered. She said, we call you Mr. Magoo because you're short and bald-headed and squinty-eyed, you mumble when you talk and you shuffle your feet when you walk. Everybody in the class is applauding her. Boy, she was taking bows to them and all this, you know. She was the local hero. I sat and looked at her with Al-Anon eyes. And I said to myself, Susan, you're going to have a hell of a time getting an A in this class. The bell rang. They walked down the hall. I thought they were going to put her up on their shoulders the way they were making such a fuss over. But that was great. I loved the kids I taught, and I think they loved me. You know, I think every man, at least, probably women too, I don't really know, but I think at one point in a person's life, they reach the most exciting moment. The superlative degree there. It never happens again. It cannot, to that degree, ever happen again, because it's the most pleasant moment in a lifetime. And I had that one day at a high school I was teaching at. And, well, I loved these kids. I really did. And I knew they liked me because this was the end of the year assembly, when each chairman of the department gave out an award to the student of the year for that department, like math and history and English and all that. I was chairman of the English department, and I was about the fifth one to be called up to the podium on the stage. And when the other chairman applauded, but when they called my name, this only happened once in my life, it will never happen again. When they applauded my name, all of the students stood up and applauded. All of them. And the faculty applauded, the principals applauded. This was just after my wife died, and that may have had something to do with it, really. But I stood there and I said to the microphone, if you love me, please sit down. And they sat down. That's the peak of my life. I will never, ever live that moment again. But I get near that moment when I get around all of you, because I know that you accept me, whether I look like Mr. Magoo or whether I look like anybody, you accept me. You know that I'm standing up here sharing with you, and that's how we grow. Listening is for learning, sharing is for healing, and I'm healing. And until I die, I hope to be healing. I don't want to go, as I said, through that again. Sponsors. They have a lot of sponsors. I bet I'm the only person any of you know. And listen, oh boy. This is another thing I'm kind of ashamed of, because about 1974, when I was an authority on everything at the meetings, during that year, two men called me. I don't think they even knew each other, but they were months apart calling me. Each man said the same thing. Paul, don't ever tell anybody I was your sponsor. That's what they said to me. Don't ever tell anybody I was your sponsor. That's what they said to me. But that didn't slow me down, you know. I mean, I had this motivation to be a big shot. I had told several people in AA and new people in AA that if they don't get over big shot-itis, they're going to go out and drink. We don't have any big shots here. We don't have any celebrities here. I see people become celebrities and I worry about them. The greatest is the least of all and the servant of all. And we build the foundation of our program on love, tolerance. I think Dr. Bob says that somewhere. Love and tolerance. And certainly we build it on helping other people, you see. And we grow. We grow into a different type of person than we were. And God assists us when we ask. We work the steps. That's what sponsors are for, to help you work the steps. I bet you one out of maybe 15 people that I ever sponsored got the program. Those are not very good statistics, and maybe it reflects on me not being a good sponsor. But I do know that anybody I sponsor, I try to spend time the first 30 days with them every day. And I know that we go through the steps, and I'll teach them what I can from my experiences, you see. That's all we're doing. We are not generalizing on anything about AA. We are saying that my experience as an alcoholic was this. This is what I'm doing to recover, and I will share these things with you. But don't consider me an authority on anything, because I'm not. This is what I tell them. And we work the steps together. I find more trouble sometimes with the second step with people, because they don't like this word, sanity. Restore you to sanity means that you're not sane. Of course, in the beginning, everybody's sane. I mean, I certainly was. I mean, I didn't have to be here. Nobody ever. I only was in jail once in West Palm Beach. I forgot to tell you that. So we got three other teachers and I decided one Friday we were going to go down and see the girly shows. This is before they had girly shows in Orlando. You know, they had these girls behind bars up on the, and a cage up on the bar, and you would sit there and get drunk and watch all their gyrations, you know. So three of us called in sick. And we drove down to West Palm Beach. This is a Friday. Oh, I want to tell you this before I forget it. If you have any children in the Orange County school system, don't be afraid of some of the things I'm saying here, because no other teachers did this. I mean, the teachers in Orange County are super people. They really are, and I don't want this to reflect on their image. But we went down there. And we were going in and out of these bars in the middle of a very bright day. The bars were dark, you know. And about 10:30 at night, I'm staggering around downtown West Palm Beach. We had been out in the boonies quite a bit and then came downtown. And I lost these three guys. And I'm walking around a street not far from the Greyhound bus station. I visit there once in a while to see if my memory is still correct. And it is. Near the Greyhound bus station, a big policeman. If you any of you know Jim Wilson, the attorney who was in the program for a long time, this man looked like Jim Wilson. And big guy, and he had hands like hams. They were so big. And I had a jacket on. We were well-dressed. We were well-dressed teachers going in all these places, you know, impressing people with our importance. And this policeman walked up to me, and he grabbed this lapel on my jacket with that big hand. And as he grabbed it, he said, "You're drunk, and I want..." Bam! And I hit that man as hard as I could. When I woke up, my head was underneath a urinal that was sitting on a couple of cement blocks, and the contents of it were coming down on the right side of my head. And I found out that there was another policeman. Well, that's gross. I know it is, but this isn't... My story is not clean, you know what I mean? These things happen, and if I don't share them with you, I'm lying to you. But anyway, they kept me there for a while. They thought they wanted me. I don't know why they thought they wanted me. They kept fingerprinting me, you see? And I kept saying, "Look, I'm a teacher in Orange County. This is all I am, nothing more than this. What are you doing? We want you. We know. We all know you from somewhere." Anyway, after a few days of letting me go, it cost me $400 or $500. But that's my That's my crime record. That's the only time I was ever arrested. I never got a DUI. And God knows I should have. Oh, Lordy Moses, I should have. I got to watch the time. What time should I quit? 20 minutes, 25 minutes, 8. What do you think, 15 more minutes? Can you hang in there that long? Okay. So anyway, and then about 1969, I started to... I took my coffee jug inside of my lunchbox, and I, instead of putting coffee in, I put grapefruit juice and vodka, and in the middle of the day, I'd sit in my classroom at the desk and eat my sandwich, and I had my cocktail. And I thought that was so neat, you know. I thought the kids were so good in the afternoon when I did that. But that's when you're really starting to get sick, you know. What happened was there was a student, I got certified in reading in addition to English, and there was a couple of boys that belonged to some big shot at Martin's, I forget their name now, but they had reading problems, and I identified them, and I showed the one how to help improve his reading problems, and he did it, and he started reading better. So one Saturday morning, I'm painting my classroom, and this strange man comes in, and he says, "When I'm elected to the school board of Orange County, you're never going to paint your classroom." So I thought, you know, who is this clown? So he told me he was the father of these two boys, and he knew what I had done for them. And he says, "Are you certified to be an administrator?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "I'm going to make you a principal." In the 70, I was made a principal. Now, by 70, I was drinking, folks. I was made a principal of Delaney Elementary in downtown Orlando. Maybe you know where that is. It's a senior citizen center now. And that year, I decided I was going to quit drinking, so I drank beer only. Well, I was brought up on beer. My dad made beer in the basement, but I didn't drink a case a day. But I did in that year. And that year, I was drinking a case of beer a day. I weighed 186 pounds that year, and now, today, I weigh about 156. That's how much weight beer put on me. So at the end of the year, I said to myself, "Oh, hell, this is..." Oh, I shouldn't... I'm just being recorded, so I don't want to say anything unpleasant, but I said to myself, "I don't have to worry about it anymore. I'm not going to drink beer. I'm going to drink liquor." And I did. And you know what happened? The school board promoted me. They made me principal of a school that had never had a white principal before in Eatonville. In 100 years it was there, I was the only white principal they had. And you take over a school on July the 1st, and I took it over on July the 1st, and the first thing I began to notice is when I took little walks around and nobody spoke to me. The faculty did not like me. When the students came in September, they didn't like me. And so I went to the school board and I said, "I want to get out of this." And they said, "No way. You're going to stay there." So about October, I was so fed up with this, I said to myself, "There's only one thing that I'm good at, and that's taking a drink." And I used to go to that ABC there on Mills 1792 near the trestle of the railroad tracks up on the hill there a little bit. 10:30 in the morning, and I'd have a double vodka. And the woman that was waiting on me, if I was 5 or 10 minutes late, she'd say, "Oh, I'm so worried about you. I thought there was a riot." Well, there were riots that year, but they never seemed to interfere with my 10:30 vodka. And that's finally at the end of the year, I said, I got an attorney, found out how to retire from administration. He had to know where an opening was. I did that. The opening was in Winter Garden, and I got everything I wanted. I went back to classroom, and I spent the next 15 years there happy. I belonged in the classroom. I was not an administrator. I really wasn't. I didn't like it at all. It was big shot audience. It was perversion in my thinking. It was my alcoholic mind always working to be a big shot. And all it essentially was, Delaney was the laziest job I ever had in my life, the principal of that school. Because in the morning, I would arrive about 8:15, pat all the little kids on the head as they walked up the steps in the school, say good morning to the parents, and nobody was bussed in. They brought the automobile, or they were walked in, or they came in on a bicycle. Say good morning, everybody. The kids left. I made some announcements about 20 minutes to 9, played the Star Spangled Banner, and got ready to watch a 9 o'clock movie. So I watched a 9 o'clock movie from 9 to 11 o'clock. My secretary was a lady, had been in the county, I think, 65 years. She didn't want me to do anything, just sign whatever she told me to sign, and I did that. So it left me a day to do nothing, really. So at 11 o'clock, that would be over, and I'd watch a half hour some dumb show. Then I'd get downstairs at 11:30 because the sixth graders, who were the big shot for the school, you know, were eating that. And so I'd walk around like a pompous donkey, making myself a big shot in front of all these kids, you know. And I'd come back upstairs 45 minutes later, and this lady would say to me, "You look sleepy. Why don't you take a nap?" So I says, "I think I will, but if I'm not awake by 20 after 2, would you please wake me, because at 2:30 the kids are going home, see? I know you think your taxes are being wasted with somebody like me in this situation, but this is what I was doing." So I'd go in there. Her office was next to mine. There was a door in between. So about 20 after 2, she'd knock on the door, and she'd say, "Are you okay?" And I'd say, "Okay, I'll be out in a minute." So I'd go out. Now the kids are going down the steps. The parents are out there. I'm patting them all ahead. I'm waving to the kids. By 3 o'clock, everybody's gone. School's empty. I'm alone. I did that month after month after month. But then finally, the school board thought I did nothing so well that they promoted me. Isn't that something? Oh, boy. Well, anyway, I don't know what else to tell you here. I love teaching. I really did. I don't really miss it. I missed some of the kids. Some of the kids I did, I missed them a lot. But others I didn't. My house, we lived on Hastings Street in Pine Hills there, at the same house for 25 years. And they aged it, I don't know how many times. Not because they didn't like me, because they were just kids, you know. I don't know how many Saturday mornings I went out to the chimney was on the front of the house and I had to wash it off. The one time, I'll never forget this, they put a sign on the St. Andrew's Church down there. That's where we were parishioners for about 25 years. On a Saturday afternoon, some kids put a sign there. See if I can get this right now. It said, "If you can't quit sinning, if you can't quit sin, come in. If you don't want to quit, call this number." And they had my number listed there, see, to call. I thought that was pretty clever. Yeah, it was. That was clever. I like that. But things were very comfortable for us after a while. I adjusted to my wife, of course. I took a heck of a lot. But then in 1987, I put my house up for sale. Nothing happened for about 6 weeks. There was a knock on the front door. A little man says, "I'm Reverend so-and-so, and I've got a family out in the car. I want to look at your house." So they came in. And they walked in the living room with a man, a wife, and six little kids. And it reminded me so much of our six little kids. Just one charter and the other. Except they were black people. Very neat black people. Lovely family. And they said, "You mind if we look out alone?" And I said, "No, I'll go out on the back porch." So I went on the back porch. They roomed all over the house. They came on the back porch and they said, "We'll buy it." I said, "Well, my daughter's got the papers. I'll call her and she'll arrange credit and all that." And they said, "No, we'll pay cash for it." So they said, "We'll give you $4,000 now and the rest Thursday." That was a Monday evening. And they did that. The next night I bought the house I'm in now. Tuesday night I bought the house I'm in now. But the next Thursday, when I bought the house I'm in now, the man said to me, "Well, this is a deal. We agree on it and everything. But I can't be out for 17 days. That's all right. So Thursday, when they gave me all this money, all of it was cash. All of it was cash on the dining room table. They gave me the rest Thursday night, and I said, "We're going to give you all this, and the man's here to, with the papers and all that, but you have to be out in 4 days." He says, "Okay." So I moved out in 4 days, all by myself. I moved a 5-bedroom house of everything. I rented a big truck alone. I went looking for people, but I couldn't find the guys. I found were either on drugs or drunk or something, so I decided to do it myself and not lose any time. And I put it in storage. 17 days later, whenever the time was to move into my house, I got out of storage, ran another truck, loaded it, took it. Now, this was done sober. Can you imagine me doing that with a gut full of vodka or full of beers and milia or anything like that? No way. No way. So, let me wind it up now, folks, because I think you're getting restless. You're a good class. Nobody threw anything at me. Nobody cussed me. Nobody called me Mr. Magoo. I was watching your eyes. You know, you can see when people are paying attention. You always stay in the classroom. You learn that. And you paid very good attention. You're all going to get an A. Okay? And a letter. Well, you're... You're the ones who should be applauded, not me. But can I have to tell you one other joke? This is an old lady joke. I told some old man jokes. I'm going to tell you an old lady joke. There was an old lady who had been alone all of her life, and for the last 20 years she had a big old tomcat. But about 10, 18 years before this, she had taken the tomcat to the vet, and he took care of it. So anyway, she was rummaging around up in her attic, and she found this vase, some of you call it. Kentucky, we call it vase, because we're not very high on dialects. But anyway, there's a vase, and she kept polishing it, and a genie appeared, and the genie said, "Now I'll give you any three things you want." And she says, "All my life I wanted to be young." And zap, she was young. "All my life I wanted to be beautiful and rich." And zap, she was beautiful and rich. "And all of my life I wanted to have for my man the person with the highest level of virility in this part of the country. A real man." And so, zap, she's in this beautiful townhouse overlooking water. And coming down the stairway is a handsome man. She had told the genie that she wanted her old cat turned into the most virile man that God could make. So coming down the stairway is this handsome man, and they glide towards each other, and he embraces her. This is so exciting. He embraces her, and he kisses her gently, and then he whispers into her ear, "Now aren't you sorry that you took me to the vet 18 years ago and had me fixed?" Well, folks, I love all of you very much. One time there was a third grade teacher. My daughter is an elementary teacher. Well, she's a supervisor in the county office now, but she's a third grade teacher for years. And this third grade teacher says, "I want all you kiddies to go home tonight and write a short story and bring it to class tomorrow. We're going to read it. And from your short story, we have to be able to learn something. A lesson must be learned from it." So the next morning, they were in class, and she called on Lillian. So Lillian stood up, and Lillian says, "I went shopping with my mommy, and we bought some eggs. When we got home, we dropped the eggs. And the lesson to be learned is, you can't count for chickens before they're hatched." So the teacher says, "Well, that might need some work, but okay, we'll accept it." So the next little girl she called on was Bernice. And Bernice stood up and she said, "I went shopping with my mommy, and she bought a quart of milk. When we got home, we dropped a quart of milk. And the lesson we learned about that is, don't cry over spilt milk." So she says, "Well, that's pretty good." So then she called on little Curtis. Where's Curtis? He was here a minute ago. So anyway, Curtis stands up and he says, "My daddy was in Vietnam. He was attacked by the Viet Cong. And all he had with him was four bullets, a knife, and a fifth of whiskey. So he drank the fifth of whiskey, put the four bullets in a gun, and killed four Viet Cong. And he took the knife and he killed seven more Viet Cong. And he chased them all away." So the teacher says, "Well, little Curtis, what can we learn from that?" And little Curtis says, "Well, we can learn from that is you shouldn't fool around with my daddy when he's drinking." Well, I told this next story to a guy in West Palm last week, a little short thing. Little girl, third grade, first day of school, teacher says, "I want you to stand up, everybody, and say your name." The little girl stands up and she says, "My name is Happy Buck." And the teacher says, "No, that's not your name. What really is your name?" The little girl says, "My name is Happy Butt." So the teacher says, "Well, after recess, I'm going to go and check the records." So the teacher comes back after the recess, and she says, "Your name's not Happy Butt, it's Gladys." The little girl says, "Well, Gladys, Happy Butt, what's the difference?" This guy in West Palm Beach last week, he knew I was a teacher, and I told him this joke, and he says, "You know, do you have a tombstone? I said, yeah, I have half of my wife's tombstone. Has my name on it. He says, what you ought to do is have somebody after you die take a piece of paper and write those words on it, put it by your name. He was a happy butt. And he said, that would exemplify all the little kids you taught that are happy. Some of them are pretty big, though. All the kids you taught that were happy. That would teach the beauty of the simplicity of AA. And I'm going to leave you with that. I'm going to leave you a happy butt. Thank you.